so now we have a story. This is the story of Beauty and the Beast. Once upon a time, a handsome prince met a fairy who asked him to marry her. When he refused, she turned him into a beast. "You will remain so," she said, "until a woman agrees to marry you." The years passed and no marriage took place. In the area, there lived a rich merchant with three daughters. One day, he asked each in turn what they would like from the market. "A dress," said one. "A pair of shoes," said another. "A white rose," said the third. He found all but the rose, and on his way home, to escape a storm, he finds a room with a table laid in a magnificent castle. He sleeps there, and the next morning, wandering in the garden, he finds a bush with white roses. As he picks one, a beast roars out and challenges him. "The rose is for my daughter," replies the merchant. The beast lets him go on condition that his daughter return to take his place. On his return, his daughter proposes that she go to the beast. And reluctantly, the merchant agrees, for he loves his daughter tenderly. She goes off, finds the garden, and enters the castle, where she finds the table laid for her. In the middle of the meal, she hears a loud roar, and the beast enters. "Fear nothing," he says. "I wish you nothing but good." The girl stays on, and every evening takes her place for supper. At first, she cannot even look at the beast, who appears so ugly. But as the days pass, she gradually becomes accustomed to his gentle, thoughtful nature. They spend their days talking or walking in the gardens. Often the beast asks her to marry him, but she firmly refuses. One evening, the beast finds her in tears. She's missing home, and fearing some tragedy, persuades the beast to let her go. But she must return within 7 days or risk death. He gives her a ring to wear, which will turn red to warn her of impending danger. She returns home to find her father gravely ill. Her sisters find her even more beautiful. Time passes, and she forgets her promise to return. The ring turns red, and she departs in haste. After an anxious journey, so attached has she become to the beast, she finds him near to death in the garden by the rose bush. She begs him not to die, telling him how much she loves him. "If you will marry me, I will live," he replies. The girl accepts, and in a flash, the beast is transformed into a handsome young man, and guess what? They live happily ever after. It's now time for the children, such as they are, to go for their program downstairs. That the children have gone. I want to spend just a few moments thinking about that story. Now, I know some of the more politically correct amongst us will see it as an affirmation of the social importance of marriage and the insistence on normative social stereotypes. But it taps into powerful themes. There is that of recognition, that moral beauty is more than skin deep, and that we should not judge people by their appearance, of reward after a period of trial and tribulation, of reciprocal love, of true affection, of mutual respect, generosity of spirit, and so on. Enough for several sermons, should anyone care to take up the challenge. I put that down as a maybe. It is an imaginative interpretation of some of our deep-seated concerns, a seemingly simple narrative, a charming tale where fundamental virtue is rewarded. We are attracted to stories that affirm certain models of good behaviour. Our culture is thus a reflection of what we value in our society. It's the stuff that holds the social fabric together. Whatever we deem to be of enduring value finds its way into our literature and, I would maintain, into a place such as this, where for a few moments we can pause to reflect on those values which inspire and direct us. We hopefully connect with something that lies beyond the everyday, the bigger picture. There are so many things out there that conflict with the need to occasionally go inside ourselves and focus on something other than the buzz of background noise, the mundane business of life, the petty conceits that dog us. The religious narrative is part of that journey. Here we can be inspired by ideas that reflect what we believe to be the essential qualities of humankind. Qualities such as perseverance, altruism, the desire for justice to prevail, perhaps even optimism for the journey we're taking. I've taken this morning's reading from an article which appeared in the Guardian Review way back in October of last year. It's by Neil McGregor. I think it was associated with the railways, if I'm not mistaken, if it's the same Neil McGregor. Anyway, the article is entitled Belief is Back, and it's headed by this statement, 50 years ago, religion was on the retreat as science advanced. Now it's center stage again. What does faith offer the modern world? And I've chosen a short extract from that article to read to you now. We tell ourselves stories in order to live. Joan Didion's famous sentence is not a reflection on religion, but it speaks to exactly that compelling need we all have for stories that give shape and significance to our individual lives. Religious stories are part of a similar strategy for communal survival. Addressing the conundrums of life and death, they offer not explanation, but meaning. As much about the future as the past, they provide a society with a narrative that goes far beyond the self, embracing the living, the dead, and those still to be born in one continuing story of belonging. Not surprisingly, evidence from the Ice Age onwards suggests that societies with such narratives appear better equipped to overcome threats to their existence, to survive and to flourish. At the beginning of the 20th century, the French sociologist Émile Durkheim argued that there can in fact be no society unless it has such shared overarching stories, what he called an idea that it constructs of itself. We are, as a group, the stories that we tell about ourselves. If, for whatever reason, we lose or forget those narratives, we collectively no longer exist. The society is, Durkheim suggested, venerating an ideal version of itself, which may one day be made real. Such narratives of faith can create wonderfully potent symbols of solidarity. One example, Hindus in Bengal celebrate every autumn the return of the goddess Durga and her triumph over the forces of evil. To mark the festival, they make each year a new statue of the deity. These painted representations of the goddess are made not by a solitary artist, but in effect by the whole community. Supported by a wicker frame, the bulk of the body is composed of clay. But great efforts are made to incorporate bits of earth from all the different parts of the locality, from rich areas as well as poor. By convention, for the mix, a priest should beg for some soil from a sex worker's house, and there should ideally be also some clay from the banks of the Ganges, as Durga has a close connection to the river. The result is that in the temporary statue of the goddess, every part of the community, rich and poor, weak and strong, is represented and honoured and connected to the endlessly renewing, life-giving river. The image Durga comes to inhabit during her festival that the people venerate thus carries within it the whole place and the whole community, physically and symbolically present. It is an image endlessly made, destroyed, and remade by the people themselves. Few political structures have found metaphors so emotionally compelling for a society in which everybody has their place. Food for thought. I think we would all agree that we like a good story. Something preferably with a beginning, a middle, and an end, where virtue is rewarded, the bad chastised, and so on. It probably appeals to us because we know that life does not always correspond to that ideal model. Life is messy. We are forever feeling we are plunged into the centre of a maelstrom of events, stumbling along, searching for answers, or at least clues as to why me, here, now, in this place. Stories reflect some of our deepest preoccupations and attempts to untangle, decipher the tangled web of human desires and emotions. Stories give us structure, organized content, a focus, a meaning. And this urge to create a narrative has, I think, both a secular and a religious context. It's my belief that the religions people follow reflect an innate desire to lend sense to the random and often chaotic context of life. They reflect the concerns of our daily lives, as well as a response to the anxiety about what may or may not lie beyond that dark night of the soul which the poets talk of. The Old Testament described a God who very much related to people's daily lives. In the olden days, you were not threatened with dire punishment after death, as occurs in the New Testament, but with drought and famine in this world. You see, agricultural productivity was at the forefront of people's minds, and so the God they believed in reflected those concerns. To believe was to survive. The luxury of desalination plants was yet to arrive on the coasts. So, a preoccupation with the threat of famine or drought centered people's minds wonderfully. In the period of the Enlightenment, God became an irrelevance, since science was going to solve mankind's problems. Thus, old stories become irrelevant, beliefs are made redundant, and we are released from the cold hand of the past, free to create new stories. Let me give you an example of such a shift in perspective. You have all heard of the myth of the tree of knowledge. In the original story, the serpent tempts humans to sin and thereby brings the wrath of God down upon them. Move forward a few hundred years to a garden where a certain Isaac Newton sits idly beneath a tree. An apple falls on his head, and his curiosity helped launch the scientific revolution, which led to God being sidelined for many people. We gained a better understanding of the universe, and so began another story that implied that if we gain enough knowledge, we can create paradise on earth. Famine, plague, and war can be overcome by abandoning old myths in favour of objective scientific knowledge. If technology can allow us to upgrade our condition, so people will care less about fictional gods. But remember, nature abhors a vacuum. So powerful is our desire to create stories that give meaning to our lives that despite the seeming benefits of a world that satisfies our material needs, we crave for something more. There is a craving at the heart of the human experience for something that transcends the everyday. As yet, no one has been able to answer the question as to where that search begins, whether the answer lies within or outside ourselves. Should we seek an answer by looking at the world and its secular institutions? Are social services the new religion? Or failing that, should we search inside? Should we be Stoics or hedonists? Shakespeare argued that there was nothing evil, but thinking makes it so. And I think he had a point. Everything is in our attitude of mind. We are, to an extent, free to choose our destinies. But whatever the case, the important thing to focus on is our capacity for imaginative, creative thinking. We want, indeed need, to believe that our lives, our stories, have meaning, and religions provide a context where that can be explored. Furthermore, religions have given birth to some pretty powerful myths. Take Christianity, for example, which spread the revolutionary idea that all humans are equal before God. This was an idea that changed human political structures, social hierarchies, and even gender relations. Jesus' insistence that the meek shall inherit the earth turned the pyramid of power on its head and provided ammunition for future revolutionaries. Such stories weave their way into our hearts and create the structures by which we live. A favourite hero of mine from literature is Don Quixote. Remember him? He was the knight in shining armour who tilted at windmills thinking they were invading armies. The delusion that his glorious quest was to rescue damsels in distress lent his life shape and focus and fed his imagination. When he regained his sanity, he died. Myths, stories sustained him and sustain us. We invest in them. We believe them. So our identity becomes a story too. From our daydreams, from the books we've read, from speeches we have heard, we weave a story about who we are. And these stories find their way into our literature and our systems of belief. By creating stories, we learn to understand the world a little better, to manage our demons, to explore our passions, and to shape our destinies. The Greeks wrote powerful plays about jealousy, incest, betrayal, lust, vengeance, and so on. They were perhaps the first to understand that to create stories about the human condition is to begin to penetrate the mysteries of what drives us on, of what makes us who we are. Of course, they invented the gods. That was their great story. But search among the authors and you will find amongst them those who put the blame firmly at the feet of mankind. But it does not matter where you place the blame. The important thing is that the imagination has been brought into play. The inner life, the reflective urge, has been set in motion. Life is a tragedy, a comedy, a farce, depending on how you read it. But it is not nothing, if you will forgive the double negative. By creating stories, we attempt to impose order on the chaotic, random nature of the universe. Religion, the spiritual quest, is but one thread in that narrative which has sustained communities through danger. I'd like to end with a final quote from the article I began earlier by Neil McGregor. Think of the African slaves transported to America and their response to their predicament. In such circumstances, religion offered an architecture of meaning in which people found hope and shelter. For many today, in areas of economic destruction, it may be the only structure available. Of course, many Europeans struggle with this view of religion. It is not that the rational mind rejects as scientifically untrue the theological or mythological frameworks of faith, or that beliefs have been manipulated consciously by rulers and priests to support the powerful and to exclude and persecute whole sections of society. Many find it hard to see here forces that will shape a better world, which perhaps explains the growing focus in the West on the individual quest for truth and private spirituality. But narratives can articulate an ideal and offer fulfillment in the context of a community, and above all, offer hope. It may represent a failure of secular politics, but it should not surprise us that so many societies now see in such narratives of faith their best way forward. Amen to that. Some closing words. Friends, thank you. I say thank you from us all to us all. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your singing and your silence, your presence and your prayers. For it is by your being that we all can know the depth of being. It is by your singing and silence that we can know a unity in togetherness. And it is by your presence that we can know that other presence here, being together. Thank you.